It's Thursday, August 18th, 2011, and you're listening to episode 243 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
This is Carla.
And this is Chris.
Alrighty, we're down several of our usuals, but we've got Carla joining us again today. And
actually, we traded up.
Oh, clearly. Clearly.
She's prettier than Pat. So. And she's already talked more.
I don't really know about that.
Well, Chris, Pat will love you for that.
Got to give my nod to Pat every now and again. So.
Yeah.
Two announcements real quick. First off, on October 7th through 9th of this year, Fear the Boot will likely be in attendance at a convention in Springfield, Missouri called the GAME Convention. G-A-M-E, it's an acronym. I will link to this off the show notes for anyone who lives in that area and is interested in joining us.
Hang on. What weekend is this?
Totally not our anniversary weekend. Damn it, I have you on one episode. I'm busted on something already.
Wow.
Very good pickup, Dan.
Yeah. So we have a lot of interest from the various hosts, but we're not sure who's going to be there now.
Yeah, it's okay.
No, that's fine. We can celebrate some other weekend. It's all good.
So the guy that is setting this up, or one of the people that's involved in organizing this, and this is, by the way, a tabletop gaming sort of convention. I mean, sort of thing that our crowd is into. But the guy that is setting it up owns an arcade called 1984. And from what I understand of this place, you pay like a base cover charge or something to get in. And he has the place just loaded wall to wall with all these old 1980s arcades. And
oh, yeah.
I want to get him on so bad to talk about this place. But I'm telling you, I don't know if it'll happen during the game convention or not. But at some point, I'm going down there for a take-all-comers Gorf tournament, because I'm not all that good at a lot of the 1980s arcades, but I can freaking wreck you in Gorf. In fact, I was part of the Atari Hall of Fame for Gorf.
Which one is Gorf?
I don't remember that one either, which is surprises the hell out of me, because most of those titles from that era I remember, but Gorf, I do not.
Is that the one they make fun of on Family Guy?
I don't think so.
Or no.
That might have been Q-Bert.
Q-Bert, that's what that was.
Gorf was kind of like Space Invaders, but more complicated and had like different levels where radically different things would occur. I don't know how to describe it really. Google it. You can probably find screenshots or, heck, probably even a flash version of it if you want to start getting ready to see if you can unseat me from my Atari Hall of Fame spot, which I captured when I had to take a picture on a Kodak disc film of a cathode ray tube television.
Nice.
And now who's old? Now
who's old? And then we had to take enough to find out if it turned out, because, of course, not being digital, you have no idea.
No, you can't
That's
see
right.
it.
You can't take just one picture of the same thing back then. No way.
Yeah. And so I had to then mail it off to get entered into the Hall of Fame to prove I had the score that I claimed I did.
That reminds me of the first time I hit a perfect score on a song in Guitar Hero. I left it on overnight so my wife could see it in the morning. I took three pictures on my phone to make sure I had a picture of it, just so I could prove that I had hit a perfect score on it.
Wayne, you realize you're not even in the right millennium?
I know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what was your big arcade game that you were into, Wayne, but you know, no way, man. Now you're talking about Guitar Hero. Forget that.
Because, by this point, it's like you don't have to prove anything. Xbox Live saved your score, or you're taking a picture of an LCD television with a digital camera, which is not nearly the undertaking it was to take a CRT picture with undeveloped film.
I was a big fan of Logo. Do you guys remember Logo?
Yeah, with the turtle?
Yeah, I could draw some wicked stuff.
Do you know what Logo was designed for?
It wasn't a CAD program?
No. Logo was designed originally, if memory serves, and I could be a little off on the history. I'm sure someone's going to hit Wikipedia and school me. But as best as I understand the history, it was originally designed as a language for instructing robots.
That would make sense.
For anyone who's not familiar with Logo, you had an icon on the screen. It's triangularly shaped, called a turtle. And you'd give it commands like
RT90 for
RT90 for return right 90 degrees.
And then FW forward, and then however many pixels you wanted it to move.
And you could eventually then put these into loop structures, like, you know, for next loops or do until loops or whatever. And it would follow these commands. And the way it was explained to me back in the 80s when I was first taught Logo was that it was designed for robots. In fact, we actually had a guy from some local university or something come out with a robot that was hooked up to Logo. And he put it on a big sheet of paper, like newsprint.
And it drew?
Yeah, and as you typed in the commands, this robot would drive around the paper and draw what you were telling him to draw.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool stuff. I mean, nowadays it's like nothing, but...
I'm more impressed by the fact that they had video games in the third world. You're from a third world country, right, Carla? They had the fact that they had those there. That amazes me right there.
Why don't you call my mom up and ask her where she's from? She'll love to tell you. Do it in person, that'll be even better.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'd end up with my ass kicked, I'm sure. So
we never really had arcades near me when I grew up, so most of the games I played were either at the laundromat or at like Walmart outside or at a Pizza Hut. So it was Pac-Man, Mario Brothers, X-Men, the side-scrolling X-Men one, played a lot of that.
That's how I became a fan of Cyclops, and since then I found out, because I wasn't into comics growing up, but on that arcade game, I was always playing Cyclops, so I became a Cyclops fan, only found out later his character's a total douche. But that's also how I became an Iron Man fan, was in the side-scrolling Avengers game. I always played Iron Man.
Oh, I love that game.
And then later in life, I developed a love for powered armor, and then eventually found out that Tony Stark's character, especially the whole demon in a bottle thing, was kind of a neat character. And so I got a more, I don't know, mature appreciation for Iron Man, but
mature.
My big one when I was heavy into the arcades was, I mean, I liked a lot, and of course, you know, Spy Hunter always kind of rises to the top, that one, and Tempest to a certain degree, although Julie was, she was much better at Tempest than I ever was. She was very good at that. But Dragon's Lair, the Laserdisc game, that was my game. I ruled the roost on that one. It took a hell of a lot of quarters to get there, but that one was a blast.
Space Ace?
I tried Space Ace, and I couldn't get into it. It just wasn't the same for me.
Yeah, I couldn't get anywhere on either. It'd be like, what am I supposed to do? And then I die. And then somebody would tell me, you're supposed to do this. Okay, I'm pounding the button. You died anyway.
Yeah.
It was a serious game.
You had to have a lot of timing. A lot of timing expertise with that one.
So was Castlevania considered an arcade game?
There was a Castlevania stand-up arcade. I don't know which came first, the Nintendo game or the arcade game, but there was a stand-up arcade game of Castlevania.
Because I was never really into arcade games, but I was really into the original Nintendo.
I played Castlevania on arcade at a roller skating rink.
Nice.
At a birthday party, a roller skating birthday party.
Oh, yeah.
I love roller skating birthday parties.
All right, so moving into this century, Wayne, you want to give a shout out to a guild that is not being run by us, but has a bunch of booters in it.
Yeah, I got a PM the other day that Champions Online went free to play a little while ago, so anyone that wants to play the game can play it without having to pay the monthly subscription. So a bunch of booters got together, started playing the game, and they created a super group named Awkward Confessions. I was so touched that it was named anywhere connected to me that I wanted to give a shout out to those guys. They're doing all their organization through the forums, so there's a thread on the forums talking about it and with all the information. Champions Online only has the one server, so if you want to play a free MMORPG, sign up, get it downloaded. Doesn't matter where you create it, because there's only one server to create it on.
I'll be sure to get that thread linked in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with these guys and join up with some other booters on Champions, you will know where to do that. As for me, I'm still playing WoW about once a week, and that's really about it right now.
I actually broke down and reactivated City of Heroes the other day, so I'm back in City of Heroes.
Well, you're hooked.
It's starting to sound like, and Aaron Stack's going to hate me for this, because he and I were like a party of two on this. We're like the only two people in the world, and I realize it's like geek heresy, who are not excited about the Old Republic, just don't think it looks that interesting. And when I let this slip to him, he's like, thank you for saying that. I like the first person I've heard say that. But it's sounding like everybody and their dog is going to be there.
Is this an MMO?
Yeah, it's an MMO.
Oh.
And
even Chad says he's going to forgo his normal 9
Really?
Month
role. Well, and see, I wrote a blog post, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago, explaining my opinions on MMOs. And I'll probably link that in the show notes as well if anyone didn't read it. But my basic conclusion was they're all about the same, and since they're social in nature, I'll just go where the most people are. So since apparently everyone else is going to be over there, I went ahead and broke down and pre-ordered. We haven't picked a server, but we're going to go PvE Sith side. So we will be playing Sith. I'm going to be a bounty hunter of some kind, just because that's the powered armor and laser gun class on the Sith side.
The only problem I see with MMOs, and I mean, the only one I've really played was that Star Trek one that apparently crashed and burned horribly.
Yes.
Is that unless you consistently play with everyone online all of the time. Everyone just leaves you in the dust and you're in levels way, way behind. And it's just not fun when everyone wants to do things and then you're like the little brother that wants to tag along. Well, and
City of Heroes did that better than any of the others, but that is a consistent problem across every MMO.
Because I can't just come home and sit behind a computer for another 4 or 5 hours and play for hours and hours and hours.
As Wayne said, some MMOs handle it better than others. Like in City of Heroes, if you want to do my mission, I can make you a sidekick, and that brings you up to one level below me temporarily. If you need help on your mission, I can mentor where I drop down to your level temporarily. And so even though I'm level 50 and you're level 20, I can make you level 49 or make myself, 21 or 20 or something to that effect.
Yeah, right around the same.
Around the same level, so that even if I left you in the dust, we can still do things
together. I'm just surprised more games haven't implemented some a similar system, because it makes it...
Well, the first...
It's just not as fun when everyone else is level 60 and you're still down in the 30s or whatever.
And for example, WoW has still not implemented it. Yet, I believe the first MMO that did it, which is surprising, was EQ2. And it's surprising because EQ1 was probably one of the most punishing games regarding level disparity. And in EQ2, I believe they were the first MMO to have some kind of a level up, level down system. And I hope that's going to be an Old Republic. I honestly don't know. All right, I got a rant. This one comes from, really, Gen Con every year, but also comes from family gatherings and a variety of other things. And this Dan rant is entitled, "Damn it, put that game down." For my family, I was introduced to a game called Apples to Apples. Now, Apples to Apples is a damn fun game. If you've never played this game, I highly recommend stopping by any local store and picking it up. This is one you don't have to go to an FLGS to pick up. Someplace like Target or Walmart will probably have Apples to Apples.
I still really want to try it sometime. I've never played it.
I don't really like that game.
It's fun.
I do. I find it highly enjoyable. Until every party, every convention, every family gathering, some dumb mother has to pull out Apples to Apples. Like, hey, let's play Apples to Apples again. Never mind the fact that this is like my 12th time this week playing this game. At Gen Con 2 or 3 years ago, it was Are You a Werewolf? Fun game. I enjoy it. The first 30 times in one night. This convention, I won't name the game, but there was another game where it's one of these beer and pretzel games. It was fun to play. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed playing it, but I had to be very proactive to dodge the bullet because every 30 seconds someone was trying to rope me into another game of it. And it's like, seriously, this game is not that fun after about one or two hands.
So after recording, let's play Apples to Apples.
Yeah. I said you shouldn't be saying that about BattleTech, Dan.
Well, I wouldn't say about BattleTech. BattleTech you can play again and again and again. You just can't go past about 3053.
But you know what? I know what you mean, because it is fun for a while. If for some reason, everybody's level or threshold in being able to tolerate a game like that is wildly different than your own. You know, when you're ready to move on or just to stop playing games altogether and, you know, maybe talk or something.
Right.
You're ready to quit, but other people they don't want to put it down. They want to keep going as if it's going to be a little bit different.
Yeah.
And really the fun in games like that, it's funner when it's on a drip rather than when the faucet's on full blast. To use a really bad analogy.
Well, it's like an incontinence analogy. That was the first thing that came to mind.
That's right. When you're having urinary tract problems, when it's on a drip, it's much more enjoyable than when it's on a constant stream.
When it's on a constant stream, you know, then your diaper's full and you got to page the nurse to come in. And
Exactly.
With just a little bit of drip, you know, you can still feel pretty comfortable throughout the rest of Matlock, right?
Yeah, you can get by for a couple of hours, before it becomes a real issue.
I love Matlock.
Who doesn't love Matlock?
You're half his age. You know,
he's an adorable folksy lawyer, and that's just kind of the way he is.
Well, you just like him because you look like him.
Yeah, very true. We do have very similar hair color.
Yes.
You're half his age, and he's half Chris's age.
You know, I guess, though, in my case, this did actually work out kind of positive, because it was my annoyance at these utterly repetitive games that got me to go out and buy other games. So I could basically counter, like, let's play Apples to Apples. No, let's play Catan. And that's how I started buying a whole lot more board games than I'd previously owned. And now I'm kind of at the point where Catan's becoming a little bit of too much of a family fallback. So I got Puerto Rico and whatever and some other games so I can...
Catan's a good game, though. Now that we know how to play it the right way.
Yeah,
it's like a whole new game.
Yeah, I've had that burnout a lot. I mean, I go on about how much I love Flux, but I've been burnt out on it occasionally because it's one of those games where it can either be really long or really quick, and it can just be game after game after game.
I'm with you, Wayne. Flux is an awesome game. I think everyone has to find the right flavor of it because there's slight variations between Monty Python Flux versus Martian Flux versus Zombie Flux versus Pirate Flux. I mean, you got to find the flavor for you. And once you do, enjoyable game. But once again, it seems like everyone out there has a much bigger gullet for this than I do.
You know, and it's funny. I was actually almost that guy this past Sunday at our gaming session. When we sat down before we started, one of the players, he wanted to show us Lunch Money. And I knew that that game has been out for a while, but I had never played it before. And I knew it had a reputation for being a fun game. You know, we played a couple hands of it, and it really was. It was a blast. And it's not so much in the gameplay, although that is definitely a factor. It's in the cards. It's in the artwork and in the text that's on the cards that's really the attraction with that game. And we had a really good time. And when we got done with like two or three hands that we did play, I felt myself wanting to actually continue to play rather than, you know, whip out the game that I was supposed to run that night. I had to catch myself and back, you know, take a step back and say, nope, everybody's here really to game this, so we have to actually do this. But we were able to play a couple more hands later on, so I was able to, you know, scratch that itch a little bit more. But yeah, I almost was that guy for a moment there.
Chris, you're always that guy, one way or another.
I am. I really am that guy. It all depends on the definition at the time, but it usually ends up defaulting to me.
You're always that guy that's posted on my Facebook page. You're always that guy.
I know. I've done that too to others, to friends of my wife as well.
Yeah. You make life kind of awkward when, like,
my whole church is on there.
Yeah. And then
and there's some really ultra-sexual posts about Dan on my wall.
I don't mind when you do that to me.
I'm here to help.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. You're helping a lot.
Before we dig into today's meat and potato topics, I want to give a quick reminder that if you haven't already, go out and check out John's Blood Moon Goblins Kickstarter. He's working on a great product, and on top of that, the video that he has, a promo video, is freaking hysterical. Even if you don't have a dime to give, at least go and watch that video, because it will be worth the clicks.
You know, Chad wasn't there for the recording, but I was recording it on my phone, and I played him a couple clips for it, and he was just busting up laughing.
Oh, you
it was
should
really
see,
good.
You should see it with the visuals, because it takes on a whole new level of hilarity with all the visuals and the sight gags and the editing. It is freaking awesome. So I can't wait for people to start checking this out. Probably by this point you already have, because it will have been out for about a week by the time this show drops. And of course, check the show notes for that link if you don't have it memorized, which I'm guessing no one does. Heck, I don't. So let's move on to today's main topic, which is invasion games. Chris, this one was your idea. So do you want to preface what we are talking about here? And then we'll dig into the various points of discussion.
Why, yes, Dan, I would be happy to do that. Thank you. I don't know if you did this publicly or if you did this just when we were having conversations, but you had a rant against the movie Skyline. I saw that movie as well, too, and it was probably one of the more disappointing endings to a disappointing movie I've ever seen.
You
more
think?
Disappointing. That is how you're going to describe one of the worst on-screen abortions I have ever seen in my life.
Yes,
it really was bad
yes,
as a movie.
Yes, it was.
I mean, not only was I scratching my head at the ending, wondering what just happened, but also I was wondering why I even bothered to get to this point anyway in the
you
first
want
place.
That time of your life back.
Yeah,
you just wasted
it's like,
it.
Huh, I guess I really didn't care about these characters, so good. I'm glad they all got sucked up into the ship. But on top of that, though, there, at least recently, been a lot of alien invasion-based movies. Battle Los Angeles, you've got Falling Skies, which is on TNT right now. Of course, Skyline. And then there's, I know there's a couple others, too, I've seen some recent trailers for. I think there's one called, like, Darkest Night, and that one's coming up later this year. And, of course, then there's the benchmark, you know, Independence Day movie as well as others. But anyway, the idea here is...
Recently had the V reboot.
V, there you go.
I guess really even the Battlestar Galactica reboot is kind of, I mean, not exactly, but it's kind of an invasion movie.
It gave the same kind of feel.
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly because it's more about a flight movie. They're running to get somewhere, but it is kind of invasion-esque.
But the idea here is, of course, in a lot of these movies, there's something within there that allows the humans, who are usually the victims here, to have... not a level playing field, but at least be able to compete and do something with, to their invaders. But, you know, the reality of that situation is usually not such. You know, it's always very clear that a highly technological force that comes in is probably going to wipe everybody out. Which, of course, is also not very desirable because that would be a really boring movie as well. So,
Chris, you mean aliens that are allergic to water wouldn't try to invade a planet that's so full of water?
I know. That
would just start off in a high humidity Midwestern state.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, are you talking just alien invasions or any invasions? Because I'm thinking Terminator, iRobot, some of those other movies that
really were... the subject would be broad enough to cover any kind of invasion. But the subject here is how do you balance that so you can have something that is plausible and seems realistic enough to your players, but at the same time allows you some, you know, role playing and game opportunities to actually do something with that setting.
The first thing I've got to say is that what has really started to annoy me in the invasion plotline is there's become a very set formula to it, which is everybody's having a normal day, bad guys show up, do something with overwhelming force, good guys are on the ropes, and then they find a panic button. Because these aliens, for all their brilliance, haven't figured out distributed computing. And so one missile to the right ship and the whole invasion collapses. This works to a point. But it has gotten to be where I just know this is how every alien invasion movie is going to end. They're not going to beat them through attrition. They're not going to beat them through diplomacy. They're not going to defeat them through strength of will. It's going to be through finding a panic button that an otherwise ingenious race could not have noticed was there. I mean, couldn't you have put a freaking grate over the thermal vent? I mean, it's just not there. And
how about a firewall to avoid a virus?
A virus, yeah.
A virus written on a Mac. I mean, come on. So one of the things that we were kicking around here prior to recording that I think is a great place to start is to look at real history for ideas. Now, as with everything we say on the show, I don't recommend a one-size-fits-all to every situation. But what I would recommend is look at how these things go in real history. What happened when the Spaniards showed up and faced the Aztecs? What happened when the Greeks and then later the Romans showed up in Israel? What happened when
the Germans rolled over country after country?
Drove around the Maginot Line.
Or the Americans showed up in Vietnam. I mean, there are a lot of stories about a superior force or a quote-unquote superior culture, a more dominant culture, I guess let me put it that way, showing up to oppose a weaker one and how that plays out. And the sad and unfortunate fact is, in most cases, it doesn't play out well for the invaded. More often than not, the invaded remain invaded unto either utter destruction or they at least remain that way for a very long while. And I guess let's start there with how the invasion begins. What I look at when I look through the invasions of history is two things. First of all, motivation. The invaders always had some reason to show up on the doorstep of the invaded. The theme that seems to be popular recently is resources. Whether it's they want the human bodies, they want the planet, they want our gold, whatever it is.
There's got to be something that outweighs the resources that they're going to spend.
Precisely.
Doing this.
And so resources seem to be a popular one. You look throughout history, certainly resources in terms of land, water, money, jewels, precious metals. This has never failed to be a sufficient motivator. But other motivators have included ideological ones. One force or one nation feels threatened by an ideology in the other. You can see this throughout the entire Cold War with tons and tons and tons of proxy battles between America and the U.S. In some cases, one side or the other became outright involved. In some cases, they just became backed conflicts.
There's also the sheer idea of conquest, making just simple land grabs. Now, I guess you could throw territory in as a resource to a certain extent, or even elimination of potential future enemies.
Something else that comes to mind would be the unintentional invasion. A great example of this in fiction is the Andromeda Strain, where the Earth ends up invaded on a microbial level by accident. It was not intentional. They theorized it was an exploratory alien presence that was unintentionally wiping out life on Earth. You can see this in some cases where today there are protected cultures in Africa or South America. there are actually some laws around not interacting with these people, because even if no one shows up and tries to take their land or take their stuff, which, yes, I realize that does regularly happen to indigenous people, but even if no one did that, the simple existence of an outside culture could eventually erode and wipe theirs away. There's a lot of concern in some countries around the world today that, quite frankly, American culture is eroding local cultures. I know there are legislative bodies in France that are set up to protect the French language. You can't say CD-ROM. They have their own word for it as a way of trying to protect their cultural identity.
This just keeps reminding me of the movie The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Yes.
I see Coke bottles flying out of the sky.
leads to an existential crisis among an entire tribe. That is a great example, though. But I don't think it really matters per se what this is. You just need to have some kind of a cogent reason to explain why they are here. Now, of course, the more creative the reason, the more depth you've put into the invading culture, the more interesting this invasion becomes. If they're just a cardboard cutout bad guy who shows up just to be bad for the sake of being bad because they're bad, Avatar, I'm looking at you, then quite frankly, the RPG does lose a bit of potential depth, because I think the invaders should be just as interesting and just as complex as the invaded.
Well, and that leads to the point of where do you start it? Because I think some of the best stories, you don't need to show when the invaders showed up and started what they're doing. You don't need to know every detail about how it got to that point. It's a lot more fun to jump in with the status quo already set. You've already lost the war. Now you're jumping into the people that have been invaded. I think that's a lot more fun than dealing with the invasion.
Exactly. And all of that reasoning, you know, the rationale behind that invasion can be, you know, elements and components to the discovery as part of the whole campaign. You can have your motivators for your characters doing what they're doing. I mean, in addition to survival and trying to throw off the yoke of impression that they've got on them, but also to discover why what's happening, and then using that as a weapon to exploit.
Wayne, there was a point that you threw out here, which I think is a great one, which is that when you do this type of campaign, you have to be thinking for the long term. And I think this ties in somewhat to what you just said about where do you start it, because you have to decide how long term you want to go. But sometimes an invasion occurs quickly. Sometimes it is blitzkrieg. I think it is a plausible scenario that we could wake up tomorrow. I'm not saying this is likely, just plausible. We wake up tomorrow and there are flying saucers surrounding our planet. But this is also something that could occur slowly. Maybe you are there while the invasion occurs. Maybe it starts as a beachhead or a series of intelligence actions that slowly leads into a full-scale invasion over the course of days, weeks, months, years. And I think you certainly do have to make the decision of how much that story do you want to tell.
Yep. And at that point, you have to look at your players and right. See what are they interested in.
Because some of them may find that too discouraging, that you spend the entire first 2 dozen sittings of this game getting your ass kicked and running, and they may find that entirely too discouraging, or they may draw a line in the sand where they shouldn't try and stand and fight before they're ready, and you've got either a party wipe or a shallow explanation of why the bad guys just didn't bother to wipe them or something to that effect.
Well, and I think that's a harder problem to deal with, because so many players have that mentality that, oh, he's throwing a combat at me that I'm sure will be a challenge, but we should be able to overcome it. And suddenly when you realize, no, you can't. I mean, I was in a campaign once where the GM very flat out said in the beginning, he said, my philosophy is that there are first level characters, but there are no first level adventures. And what he was essentially saying to us is that you need to be prepared to run and run a lot until you feel that you can actually take what's being thrown at you. And we did. We spent a lot of time running, but at least that we had the foreknowledge to know that that was okay to do that.
Well, and I think that's it right there. I'm not sure I buy the philosophy in regard to D&D. There's no such thing as a first level adventure, but however, I do think you've hit on a valuable point, which is I think the game master needs to clearly convey to the players, look, part of this is you are facing superior force. Going after the guy that has an M16 when you have a sharpened bamboo stick is probably not going to end well for your side. You can do it if you want, and maybe you'll pull it off, but don't be afraid to run away. In terms of starting, though, right in the middle, a story that I think handled the alien invasion thing very well up until the end was Inv Invasion, or Genesis Climber Mousepedia, or whatever the heck the thing was originally called. But the Inv Invasion starts off with a guy crashing on Earth, and it's already invaded. It has already happened. In fact, they were the first relief force sent, and they fail. You know, and the story they tell thereafter up until the end, where the ending is pretty Deus Ex Machina, but up until that ending, it's a story about people who sometimes fight and sometimes run, who have to manage their resources, who are trying to build support for an underground movement, who are trying to study and understand their enemy to see where they're weak politically or technologically. It's like you said, Wayne, these are people that are in it for the long haul. They're not looking for a magic bullet of, hey, if we just shoot this one thing, the whole alien invasion disappears.
It can lead to a very different kind of game. People that have that idea of, I'm in this for the long haul, can start doing intrigue, start building up their resistance, start making plans here and there, laying things out, and they have to think about that versus your group may initially think when the invasion starts, if they start off at that point, well, if I don't stop this from happening, I've failed what the GM's looking for me to do. When in reality, that's just step one.
Exactly. And it also, along with that, I think it gives the game master other elements and story threads to throw at the characters. You know, not only are you trying to deal with the attempt to drive away or throw off the invaders, but maybe depending upon where you're starting this campaign, you might be dealing with generational conflicts. You know, you might have some characters who were there when it first happened, but then you might have others from the next generation who've lived and know nothing but life after the invasion and may suddenly seem to really not want to fight the invaders. And so now you have to fight attitudes within your own species, basically.
Yeah, I was just thinking this kind of reminds me of the Star Trek games that we play, where you have to do a lot of dice rolling to go through Starfleet Academy to kind of help set up your character. You could almost use the same pre-setup to really define and use those little story threads you're talking about, Chris, to help develop some characters, to work out some of your actual character traits in the very beginning of the game, because for me, it's really hard to come up with some of those backstories, but you could kind of insert some of those into the very beginning of the game to help develop your character down the road.
And in a lot of the invasion campaigns that I've played in, I found that the most awkward part is typically describing the invasion itself, because it's very hard, I think, for a lot of people to imagine what life would be like if all at once an overwhelming force shows up and takes over. And I think it is very hard for a lot of people to imagine how they would respond in that situation. And so whether you're running or standing and fighting or trying to manipulate the situation, it all feels very artificial. And since it may take a while for this force to show up and really solidify its hold, it also starts to feel fairly repetitive. Okay, we ran away today, we're doing it again tomorrow. We were dumpster diving for potatoes to make it through the day yesterday, and that's what we're doing today as well. And it gets rather mundane. It gets rather rote. I don't know, I guess wouldn't be maybe a word for it.
That's one of the reasons I would want to start. Let the war have already happened. Yeah. Because it'd be easier for me to get into it. Because I'd struggle with that. But how would you react?
And I think Carlo's onto something, that if you take a life path or some kind of a pregame descriptor of the character, you have to set out now, what were this person's formative experiences? How did he or she respond to the invasion? Why is he or she now likely to be involved in a resistance against it? What resources have they piled up, et cetera, which are things that you don't have to take those kind of awkward steps in the game to develop. Once again, one size does not fit all. Do what's right for your group. But if getting past that phase is hard, which for me as a game master, that's always been very hard, then you have the option of starting in the middle with these resources set up and their lives already explained in the context of the invasion. You were born in Korea when the Japanese have already established the co-prosperity sphere.
You know, and we're taking it for granted that there even is a rebellion. I mean, it is very possible in some of these situations. I've even seen a couple of stories like this where it's just a matter of survival. This has happened. Your group now, yes, you're fighting against them, but you're fighting against them to survive versus the group that's trying to fix everything. I find like a zombie stories are more likely to be just survival than like an invasion, because an invasion, you have an enemy you can beat.
Well, and also depending on the invasion, you may or may not have an enemy you can reason with. And so therefore, there may be discussions about, should we fight? Is maybe life actually better under Roman rule? Or is this a society where if we appeal to the right people, we might actually be able to convince them just to go away and not do this anymore. And that's a much better solution than thousands of people dying in a war.
That was a point I was going to bring up, or question, I guess, really more is, you know, the end game result, you know, is that something that you lay out beforehand so that the players are behaving in a one way or the other? Does the game master say, look, this invading force cannot be surmounted, especially with what you've got now, but you can continue to try because there's stories that maybe they can be, or you could take the option of just simply trying to get out of their sphere of influence and make a better life for yourself elsewhere. Do you think it's worthwhile to lay such things like that out, or do you let them try and discover that halfway through the campaign?
I think it's a good idea to find out what your players want and kind of tailor it to that. If your players want to cause the rebellion that's going to take them down, then try to make that possible. If they want to just hold out till help comes and be an integral part of the help rescuing them, that's something you can do. Or if they just want to get away and have their own society outside of the rule, you know, make that possible too. I think everyone would be happier, though, if you could figure it out within the first gaming session or two what their long-term goal is. Because it all goes back to this kind of game. I can't imagine trying to do it without it being a long-term trying to get to some point.
Well, yeah, you could have an overarching or a story arc to the whole thing, and then you can do little episodes for some of those smaller pockets like you were just talking about. Do those individually and then have a massive long-term goal.
Going back to your Invid example, Dan, that Rick, I believe his name was, the main character in that series, those were the struggles he faced. He had a set goal. He wanted to go and get to Reflex Point and defeat the Invid invaders. That was his goal from day one. But he was a dedicated soldier to do that. But he had to fight a lot of struggles along the way with people who had differing goals. And it took a lot of convincing to get some of them to join him. And he failed in some attempts and succeeded in others.
Yeah, I personally love the intrigue in this kind of thing. If you're behind enemy lines, if you're, say, being put to work or something, you have to be doing all of this in your off hours. You have to figure out where you're going to meet. You have to figure out secret codes to send the messages out, hiding points, and things like that. But if your goal is to just get out of town, that's not going to come into play. If your goal is to just survive, it might come into play.
Well, and I think a lot of this goes back to a point I made, and this is one where, at least in my opinion, this is something that ought to be done, period. You have to have depth to the invaders, because understanding their weaknesses, understanding how believably you can either escape them or defeat them or undermine them or subvert them against their own cause, comes down to giving them depth. Are there individuals, maybe even in the invasion force, who don't agree with the reason for the invasion? Why does their technology work? Why are they here? What are they after? What are the kinds of things that would discourage them? And I gotta say that I realize this now goes back to my personal tastes, and one size doesn't fit all once again, is if the ending is really sandboxy, then I don't think you would know how this ends. You would just know, look, here's possibilities, because I've thought enough about these guys. I know what would motivate them or demotivate them. But if you decide that, hey, I want a really scripted ending, or I want some kind of notes here, you could at least bullet point out, look, here's a few approaches that might work. See what way the group is going. And if they seem to be going after, okay, this is number 3 on my list of weaknesses, you start having them meet up with people who tell them more about the enemy's weaknesses in area number 3 and kind of get them moving in that direction so you can kind of follow them on to the end.
I got kind of a more specific question related to what you're talking about, Dan. Like, let's say one of the options you had in an invasion game would be, okay, we want to insert some spies, or we want to do something to get weapons for them to research and see about maybe replicating weapons that will actually be on par with what they're doing.
Right.
So let's say you can do that, but of course you would need a certain amount of time to research and then redevelop and then distribute those weapons. Would you, in a game, just move time faster for that period, or would that be one of like your overarching plot lines? How would you handle something that would, in a movie, you know, you'd almost need like a montage or something to cover it all in a game like this?
I think it would depend on, first of all, where you're starting the game. Because if you're starting the game
post-invasion. Yeah, let's assume it's like Fallout. Everything's already happened. Boom.
I think there's two ways I would handle it. One is I would have to find some way where either they get it more quickly, such as maybe there's a sympathetic person on the enemy side who leaks some things to them, or you're able to seize convoy that has some of their weapons. The other thing that I would consider is to make the game more chapter-based. The first chapter ends with the group getting a hold of a data core of theirs and says, okay, over the next year, you guys go to this underground government complex where you start working through it. And you kind of talk through, what are your goals for this year? Here's what you find on that data core, but you only have so much time. Which technologies are you going to go after? At the end of that year, you say, okay, when you guys reemerge at the start of chapter two, because of the choices you made, you've now got armored suits that are somewhat resistant to their weapons. You've managed to make rudimentary versions of their guns.
Right.
You know, or if you said, well, we chose to go after the flat route, okay. Well, you've managed to come up with avionic packages that are upgrading some fighter jets that were hidden underground somewhere, you know, or whatnot. And so I would kind of put it not in a montage, but I would definitely sort of blow past that period of time. I guess as a final option, you could have that be a long ongoing backstory, that there's a front story of the day-to-day survival, the day-to-day encounters, the intrigue, the subterfuge. But in the background, there's also a lab where people are working on this stuff. And each game in Project Research the Laser Rifle, they have made it 5% of the way. Now they're 7% of the way. Now they're 9% of the way. But that's never the main story. That's just something that's going on in the background that you kind of keep them up to date on. So I think there's several ways that you could approach
you
that.
You could almost, well, just what you're talking about with the percentage, though, that could almost kind of be a countdown to when the game ends unintentionally.
Well, it could be, but I...
Well, we're at 75% of our objective. Let's take a four-month break from the game.
Fair enough, but I wouldn't mean for it to be used that way, because to me, it's like anything else.
Well,
you know?
Come on, with the group of guys you're gaming with right now, that would happen.
Hey, we survived a lot before our current campaign finally died. But, you know, it wasn't like, for example, in World War II, the advent of the radio-detonated anti-aircraft shell. It did a lot to help us against both Germany and Japan. However, its advent was not a countdown to the end of the war. Now, granted, the A-bomb was, but that's kind of a unique sort of thing. But at that point, we were kind of, you know, we were the invaders and technologically more advanced, not the other way around. So one of the things that I was thinking of, another great historic model here for looking at the scale of things and the variety of responses, is the Moorish invasion of Spain and the Reconquista. I mean, the Reconquista took, what, 500, 600 years?
You're looking at me like I actually know
I
this.
Mean, it, well,
I'm sorry, I don't know anything
you
about it.
Here's one. This one's easy to remember.
I know I'm from a third world country, but I don't know this stuff.
The Moors...
Chris remembers. He was there. Yeah.
Chris, what was it like when the Moors first showed up across the Strait of Gibraltar?
It was very warm that day.
These were a little rough.
That may have been because I pissed myself in fear as I watched them coming over the horizon. But
you know, there were people that worked with them. There were people that worked against them. There were cities in the northern part of Spain that managed to hold out for really through the end of the Reconquista. But the Reconquista, I mean, it started... I don't have a history book in front of me, but I mean, you're talking somewhere between 1000 AD. I mean, it was somewhere before
that's
that.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
And the year it ended is really easy to remember. The final town was recaptured in 1492. Same year as Columbus's voyage to, you know, the New World.
When you sailed the ocean blue.
So if you think about it, this was something that happened over a long period of time. Now, I realize the average RPG campaign, you're probably not looking to cover 500 years or 600 years or whatever of history. I get that. But my point being, though, these things don't always happen overnight. The American Revolution, I mean, that took several years to occur. This was not, and if you look at the seeds of dissent prior to that revolution occurring, that took a long time to occur.
A lot of early propaganda, swaying opinions, yeah, and things like that.
The Vietnam War went over 2 decades. And by over, I mean across 2 decades, not over 20 years. You know, et cetera, et cetera. I guess it did go over 20 years if you include maybe the French parts. I don't remember when they first showed up. But the point being here, these were not always short-term endeavors.
You know, Dan, all your talk about a well-developed, you know, invading force, that kind of gets to a pet peeve of mine. I absolutely hate when you're dealing with a movie or whatever, the concept of these are hyper-advanced aliens that have all this technology, but at their heart, they're really just monsters. Okay,
always bothered me too.
Yeah, this is a thing where they have all these spaceships, but they're running around naked, just lashing out at you with their tentacles.
Yeah,
and
they're like big beetles, and they can build these complex constructs.
Yeah, and then you lock them in a cage, and at first chance, they lash out and try to kill people. If you as a person are in an enemy camp in a cage and you get a chance to grab one of them, chances are as a player, you're not going to just kill a random guard when you're in the middle of the camp with everyone else around you. You're going to be looking for a chance to sneak out.
Well, that's the thing.
But these are always just mindless monsters, so of course it's going to attack.
The Deus Ex Machina I'm talking about is the fact that these races, for some reason, despite all their technology and all their advances, are just implausibly stupid. Now, don't get me wrong. I recognize even the most sophisticated...
And very single-minded of purpose.
Yeah.
Right.
And I recognize the most sophisticated of races make huge blunders. Don't get me wrong. I'm familiar enough with history to know things about, like, for example, how the UN forces massively overstretched their lines when driving back the North Koreans during the Korean War. That was, quite frankly, a military strategy 101 blunder. I recognize the fact that Napoleon and then Hitler and who knows how many other people didn't get the Russian winter. Okay? I'm not so naive here as to think that sophisticated, intelligent people or entire cultures don't do really stupid things, but the idea that they would just be so implausibly stupid.
Well, and they all eat humans.
Yeah, and they all eat humans. All right, but well,
and that's another thing is Chris mentioned it, the single mindset. These are individuals in an invading force. Each one has its own motivations, even if overall it has a motivation. One soldier is not the next soldier. They're two individual people.
Yeah.
And that's something that always bugged me because they're always seen as these are the same thing. Or if it's the invading force and the invading country, invading force is seen as evil, everyone is mustache twirling evil. You can't get through to any of them. And that bugs me.
The idea that one of the aliens might find an injured child and choose not to pull the trigger and instead just pretend he didn't see the child and walk away.
I know it wasn't an invasion story, but District 9 kind of really did a good job of taking those aliens and making them each have individual personalities. They all had like their own likes and dislikes. They chose, you know, they wore different things. They acted and interacted with each other in different ways.
Well, it's not an invasion story, but the original Planet of the Apes. You have different personalities for each ape, and you have some of them side with the humans, some of them don't.
I guess actually technically but you see it was an invasion story.
Yeah. You see why each one feels the way it does.
It's at the far end of the invasion story where even the fight is now forgotten history. But, all right, so what I want to close out on here is, so how do you beat the superior force? And I came up with categorically four ideas, four approaches you could take for what I think is plausibly defeating a superior force. And all these I drew from examples in history, and certainly this is not an exhaustive list. If you guys, my fellow hosts, have more, certainly add on. Or if you at home have more, by all means, get out there on the blog or get out there on the forums and add your thoughts as well. But here's the four I came up with. Number one is a lack of will or unity. An example I'd give for this one is the American invasion of Vietnam. After the Tet Offensive, the North Vietnamese were effectively spent. If we had really ramped it up, most military analysts I've heard interviewed will still say to this day, if we had stuck with it, we would have won that war.
It's hard to win a war without the support back home.
Bingo. Right. But the support back home was dissolving, had utterly dissolved by that point. It was a political hot potato. It was utterly unpopular. There were all kinds of issues with it. And obviously, the early and mid-conduct of the war were disastrous in a great many ways. And as a result, we simply lacked the will. And it is possible as well, the protagonist in your story could simply drag this out or play off the sympathy of certain factions of the invaders until unity and willpower break down and the forces simply just dissolve and leave. Yeah, there's no big bang at the end, but you know what? You still get through as the victor. Another example, this would be the American Revolution. The British had a deciding point where near the end of the war, they could have redoubled their efforts or come home. And Parliament basically said, this is costing us too much money for too little, and drove the forces back home, much to the great agitation of King George. The second one is a lack of resources. Stalingrad. You invade without the means to keep up the invasion. And especially if the protagonists or the invaded are working to defeat the invaders in terms of like whittling down their supplies or going after their convoys and things like that, it is entirely possible the invasion simply runs out of momentum. Look,
if you want to see this happen, play an RTS for any time frame at all. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, when the aliens show up on Earth, let's use XCOM, Illyrium 115 doesn't grow on trees. If you cut off their ability to produce it and their ability to bring it on world, that's the end of the invasion. They will eventually just wear themselves out, and by sheer numbers, you will end them. Because even if they kill at a 20-to-1 ratio, if you have more than 20-to-1 of them, it's over. Third-party arrival. This would be France, World War II.
Help is on the way.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. There are some really cool stories about some very brave people that did some amazing things in the French Resistance. I, by no stretch of the imagination, need to downplay the courage, the tenacity, and the resourcefulness of the French Resistance. But at the end of the day, it was the arrival of the Americans, British, Canadians, Scottish, and whoever the hell else was there on the four beaches. At Normandy, that brought an end to the Germans in France. So it is possible a third party could arrive. In the original V, while it never played out, they did find out in the first two parts of the miniseries that there was another alien race that the reptiles were at war with, and they were attempting to make contact with race. And so a possible ending of that series could have been this other race shows up. Now, they could have just as easily said, hey, we'll trade places and invade you instead.
I like the Star Child ending better.
Yeah.
Yeah, that gives your player something to do, too. Besides the staying alive, if there is someone else they can get help, that's a mission.
Yeah.
Go right. Get help.
Get them, and then convince on top of them. That, make sure you're not replacing bad with worse.
Did they actually get
watch out for the deals with the devil on that
exactly.
One.
Exactly.
Right. Did they actually get the signal out?
Yes, they did. But the way it ended was they said, we know straight up front, it is going to be years before the signal arrives, and we don't know if they'll even be listening. And so they kept on with the resistance. The resistance beat the aliens before that played out. But yes, they did send out a signal. And there was a possibility that series could have ended with a second alien race showing up to drive off the first one, and possibly at that point even befriending humanity or taking on humanity as a client species.
There's so many better ways they could have ended that.
Well, the entire ending was fine up until the damn Star Child thing, which made me want to... Anyway, the last one, and I realize this is somewhat similar to the previous ones, is poor strategy or planning. This goes back to...
So you already mentioned it. Underestimating the Russian winter.
Yeah, underestimating the Russian winter, charging too far too fast up the Korean Peninsula. But basically, whoever did this just didn't think it through all the way. They thought through the first 75% of the invasion and just didn't think about something. Now, that something should not be so ridiculous as we didn't realize there was water on Earth. But it could be something to that effect. Whoops. That maybe we didn't realize. I mean, the War of the Worlds thing's been done. But, you know, in H.G. Wells' time, that was a really original idea, that their immune system simply wasn't adapted to our planet. And they failed to take that into account. There could be any number of things they just didn't think through. And your challenge as a game master is to maybe use history as a template, but beyond that, figure out what those things might be. Perhaps they were relying on some kind of like an unstable wormhole, or they thought they could keep it stable and it collapses. And all of a sudden the invasion force is cut off. It was just poor planning. And it's going to reopen, but it's going to be a certain amount of time. So if you can dislodge the aliens before their connection to the homeworld comes back up, then guess what? You may now have their technology and be ready for them the second time they arrive.
Yep. Maybe they just sent their initial invasion force, moved their army on, and never thought that you'd be able to muster this much of a defense.
Yeah, figured since the Earth fell
this quickly.
The garrison
they leave behind is not nearly as potent as it should have been.
Yeah, or they thought if we kick your ass once, you'll lose your will to fight. We didn't count on the fact that you'd keep fighting even against the odds. So I think there are a lot of very plausible ways for an invasion to end that doesn't rely on a deus ex machina.
The only other one I would add to that is that you don't win, and that you simply have to accept the fact that the life that you knew is over, and your new goal, as we talked about earlier, becomes getting out of their sphere of influence, going somewhere else where you'll be safe from them. It may leave your players feeling like it was a coward's way out, but yet at the same time, if they look at it from the angle of, no, we're keeping the species alive, which is much more heroic than, you know, fighting to the last man and then, you know, fading into memory, it can still be a worthwhile and noble goal.
Well, and it also gives you the opportunity to continue the campaign at a later time. Like, you could put it down for a while and say, hey, we want to revisit this again. Because it's still going on.
Exactly.
It's still
you can bring
on.
Back the counterattack sequel and then do it again.
Right. You know, another idea for the you don't win, they were coming here for the water. They took the vast majority of the water. They left. What is your society like now? You know, you don't have nearly the resources you had to survive before. So now you have to figure out what is life going to be like?
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's going to do it for this topic. This is something we've been toying with for a while, but we wanted to be sure we had our notes in good order before doing it, because obviously it's a somewhat complex issue.
I'm glad you saved the history discussion for when I was on the mic.
You're quite welcome.
I just love history.
Next time we'll do spelling.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. He's talking about Words with Friends because I suck at that game.
Well, actually, at some point here, we are going to be interviewing some folks about map level world building. So we can have you on that one talk about climatology.
Well, hey, there's something I could actually contribute to.
Since you have your degrees in meteorology, which I realize is not the exact same, but
very,
you know,
similar.
That's close enough for us.
It's close enough for us. So as for the rest of you guys, thank you for tuning in. As always, don't forget to check the show notes. Have a great week, and we will catch you next time.
Ciao.
Later days.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2011. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.